You're listening to Monocle on Sunday, first broadcast on the 10th of October 2021 on Monocle 24. Good morning, we're live in London and Zurich and you're with Monocle on Sunday with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up on today's programme, we'll flick through the papers and find out more from Latika Burke. Latika, good morning. What have you found for us?
Emma, in the Daily Telegraph this morning, a plot by 40 French MPs to install French as the official language of the European Union now that Britain has quit the single market.
Thank you, Latika. We'll be hearing more from her in a moment. And we'll cross to Turin to hear about an important announcement on next year's Eurovision. We'll talk all things Paris Fashion Week, and we'll cross over to our Zurich headquarters to go through this year's edition of the Zurich Film Festival. And we'll continue our countdown of our top 100 moments as we celebrate 10 years of Monocle 24.
I started doing probably 20 to 25 puzzles per day on average, and I was getting faster very quickly. Over the next couple of years, I worked my way up to the top of the standings.
More from the American crossword champion Daniel Feyer a little later. It's the 10th of October 2021. Live from London and Zurich, this is Monocle on Sunday. Before we begin, a quick look at the headlines. Austria's Chancellor Sebastian Kurz has resigned. He stepped down after a series of raids at a number of locations linked to his party, the ÖVP. President Tsai Ing-wen says Taiwan will not bow to pressure from China and will continue its democratic way of life as tensions over the island continue. And in the Czech Republic, Prime Minister Andrej Babiš's centrist party has narrowly lost the country's parliamentary election. It could mean the end of the populist billionaire's reign in power. That's the latest headlines on Monocle 24. A very good morning to you. Let's head straight to Portugal to hear from our editorial director, Tyler Brulé. Bom dia, Tyler.
Bom dia, Emma. Good morning.
Where are you?
This morning, I am somewhere on the Portuguese Riviera. Some might call it the Lisbon Riviera. I'm somewhere between Cascais and Estoril at the moment. And it is an absolutely gorgeous morning, a calm Atlantic, almost cloudless skies, a very, very lovely day to be kicking off as we move into the next third of October.
Indeed. And what takes you to such a lovely place?
Well, weather aside, our subscribers who might have Brazilian or Portuguese addresses, or maybe an address in the Iberian Peninsula, will know that we're doing what's become a substantial event. It was going to be a somewhat low-key book signing tomorrow evening. It now feels that most of the people in the Iberian Peninsula are showing up tomorrow evening as we unveil our book of entrepreneurs. And also a bit of a late signing for our homes book as well.
Now tell us a little bit about the Monocle Book of Entrepreneurs. It's brand new, it's fresh, it's got that wonderful smell to it when you open it. What is it that's sort of exciting you the most about this latest publication in the Monocle family?
Well, I think part of it is timing, Emma, because certainly when we set out to do this, the pandemic was upon us, but it forced a bit of an editorial rethink and ongoing refresh as we went through it, knowing actually, you know, at the time when Monocle launched back in 2007, we lurched into an economic crisis at that point. And if I look back to that period, there was this great rethink that happened in 2008, 2009. Lots of people who had been working for various big corporates, people who had been working in the financial services sector, suddenly thought, maybe I don't want to do this anymore, and I'd like to go and hang out my own shingle and start my own business. And I think we're a little bit in that period as well. Of course, many people have found themselves in different situations, maybe some more positive in terms of exits from business, maybe others less so. But regardless, I think a lot of people are thinking, of course, about how they want to work, that level of independence. And that is pretty much a running theme, of course, through our Book of Entrepreneurs.
And it's always one of those things that I think Monocle is always very good at. I mean, this is barely a week. I think it's a little over a week since you were striding up and down the pavement in full lederhosen at Dufourstrasse 90, celebrating effectively small businesses who have started up and have carved their own way and indeed have found themselves not just happy, but successful.
Absolutely. And this is something that we, of course, want to repeat as well. And there will be other moments more towards the Christmas period when we'll be bringing other young firms, and I shouldn't just say young, this is about entrepreneurship. Of course, it's never too late to decide that you want to get a trestle table and peddle your wares somewhere, and that will certainly be an opportunity, both in London at our Christmas market. Strange to talk about Christmas already, and also of course in Zurich as well. Emma, can you hear the waves? Can you hear the Atlantic crashing in the background? I hope so.
I wish I said I could, but I can't. Unfortunately, I'll just have to take your word for it and just go green with jealousy. We're in this wonderful hermetically sealed studio in London, so we're just imagining fresh air and joyful waves. One thing, we are dragging you to London. You're bounding, hopefully, onto a plane to London this week for the 10th birthday of Monocle 24. Coinciding also with the media summit.
Absolutely. So this Thursday, we have commandeered, I think, a good chunk of the Churchill Hotel, the Hyatt, just around the corner from us. And we will be doing another installment of our media conference. And again, this comes at a time with so many question marks and big discussions that need to be had around the state of media today. So, and as you mentioned, it also coincides with our 10th anniversary. So great guests like Christine O'Connor coming over from France. Also, they should be talking and reflecting a little bit about a launch, which you're close to as well, at France 24. We also have Clarissa Ward joining us. We have the chief foreign correspondent for Bild-Zeitung, Michelle Hussein, will be with us. So it'll be a really wonderful evening from about 1500 onwards. Of course, all of these things always followed by a nice cocktail.
Always. What do you think you're talking about the changing landscape of media at the moment. What do you think we'll end up focusing on this week on Thursday?
Well, I think that people just should have recorded our conversation. Well, two conversations that we had last week. One, a very lovely and long dinner with our colleague Fiona Wilson, who was in from Tokyo at Kronenhalle, where I think we talked about, are we going to see perhaps a reset, particularly in broadcasting, where we've been through 19, 20 months of a lot of very homemade television and very homemade radio as well, that people talk about Zoom fatigue in the workplace, but will we move back to proper satellite lines? Will we move back to getting people into studios to be sitting up straight around microphones rather than just sitting at home and dialing in? To, of course, discuss topics of the day, but as we were saying, a lot of this is often undermined by the quality of the presentation. And yes, we should focus on what's being said, but it is television and it is radio. It's part of the entire package. So, of course, we've already dissected that at length, but I think that will be one topic, given just the amount of broadcasters who are going to be up on stage.
Tyler Brulé, we may join you later, but if not, I fully expect you to be diving into those waves in the Atlantic.
Thanks, Emma.
Thank you so much for joining us, our editorial director, Tyler Brulé, on the line from Portugal. And if you are interested in joining the Monocle Media Summit, it's happening this Thursday here in the middle of London. Go to our website for more details. You can get tickets. It will be worth it. And if you're a fan of Monocle 24, which I hope you are, you can come along too and celebrate our 10th birthday. We're in double figures. You're listening to Monocle on Sunday. It's just gone 8 minutes past nine here in London. Let's have a look at the papers. Well, let's introduce you to my presenter's friend today, Latika Burke, journalist of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, and a regular voice around the microphone. It's good to have you with us, Latika.
Emma, a pleasure to be here as always.
Okay, you've done the heavy lifting for us. I have literally just rolled up my sleeves to say what's in the papers. What have you found?
Well, there's lots of interesting stories in the papers today. One theme that's very common is the treatment of women. And I think we can deduce from the broad variety of articles that name-check Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, that she and or her team have been out spinning furiously this week, because there's some really, really interesting stuff reported. One in the Times today that Priti Patel's pretty impatient with the head of the Met Police, Cressida Dick, the commissioner. Of course, this is all after the terrible murder, kidnap and rape of Sarah Everard at the hands of a serving policeman. And there's this very intriguing line, which isn't sourced to anyone, but in the Times report, Emma, there's an intriguing line that says, Priti Patel herself asked Cressida Dick, maybe Sarah Everard was taken by a police officer in March because there were so few people on the streets during lockdown. And she asked Cressida Dick, how is it that a woman can just go missing in South London? So a very intriguing line if that is true. Now,
that is quite an allegation to make from Detective Chief Inspector Priti Patel. It's an interesting line, given the fact that she doesn't normally... We don't normally get the impression that she takes a tremendous amount of interest in things at such a granular level. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, and I have no idea what goes on inside the Home Secretary's head. But it seems like an incredibly specific request or question.
And odd to come out now. If that was asked then, why would we only hear about it now? Now, this all is set in a piece that really does lay bare a relationship breakdown between the Home Secretary and the head of the police force, Cressida Dick. It looks like Priti wants her out of the job, but of course the role is meant to be quarantined from politics deliberately, so that policing is always independent of the government, as it should be. So it does set up a very interesting question here about just how the government can act if they do deem indeed that she did not oversee a proper police force culture that enabled them to catch Wayne Cousins, possibly before he murdered Sarah Everard. Then we go over to The Guardian, and there's a really, really interesting story in here about Priti Patel here, saying she's very annoyed with Boris Johnson. Now, the two of these ministers are... The Home Secretary and the Prime Minister get along very, very well. She is a favourite of the Prime Minister and was appointed to Cabinet and indeed one of the great officers of state by Boris Johnson, particularly because they have such a good relationship. But there is this call ever since Sarah Everard's murder to make sexual harassment in public a crime. So if you get catcalled by a man, somebody leers at you, wolf whistles you, that could actually be reported to police and made a crime. Now, Boris Johnson really poo-pooed this during the week when he was asked about it at a Conservative Party conference and a range of media interviews he did then, and said that actually he would like to see the police enforce better the existing laws that are meant to protect women against crimes like this. Now, Patel herself seems to want to actually bring in a law like this, and she's very dismayed at the Prime Minister's response and fears that he is misreading the public mood in light of Everard's murder.
I mean, this to me sounds... Priti Patel is suddenly going on the front foot in all these issues.
Yes.
Why would we want that to be happening?
Well, of course, I think there's a very, very keen interest to be seen to be on the right side of this story. Also, I would not rule out that Cressida Dick may eventually lose her job over this. There's an independent inquiry that's been ordered by the government into the police force culture and into the police force itself, how they missed the killer in their midst. I would not rule out that inquiry coming down and saying actually there needs to be a big shake-up and the top needs to go, starting from the top. The other thing is, I do honestly believe that there is sincerely held beliefs in the government that this has been a real watershed moment for women's rights and women's safety in the UK. And if we have a female Home Officer who is taking that seriously, whether there's politics involved in the positioning here, it's only a good thing that we have, at least for the first time in perhaps history in this country, a female Home Secretary taking what people dismiss as granular accusations or granular activities that are perhaps signals of wider cultural issues that can lead to crimes like this.
You've been at the Tory Party conference this week. Good for you. Well done. Thank you. Mm. Someone's got to do it. What was it like? And was any of what you've just been talking about even remotely mentioned?
I think in a different sense, women's rights wasn't a huge issue, or women's safety, I should say, wasn't a huge issue on the fringes or the sideline events at Tory conference. Patel did make a very big speech where she ordered the inquiry into the policing, and that I think was one of the few policy announcements we actually had from the government. But what was really evident was this jostling amongst the cabinet that we haven't seen amongst potential rivals for Boris Johnson, the proverbial should he go under the bus, who would replace him. And I think we saw three promising candidates there. One, of course, is the Chancellor Rishi Sunak, who's long been, fated as the guy in waiting. But You have an up-and-coming foreign secretary in Liz Truss, who is very, very well liked by the members. I'm not exactly sure how she would radiate with the public. And then Sajid Javid, who, of course, has been in cabinet several times, was booted out after a big furore with Dominic Cummings and is now back in as the health secretary. And I have to say, of all the speeches, I went to watch his, and his was the best. Something has happened to him in the time he's had off. He's vastly improved. But overall, Emma, the Tory conference was just an absolute crashing bore.
Oh, no.
It was a government that
Who would ever have thought that?
A government that had nothing to say and nowhere really to go.
Well, this is an interesting point, isn't it? Insofar as they are, as it stands, unassailable. And there is this enormous contradiction going on that, you know, COVID was, to all intents and purposes, a disaster until they got the vaccine program back on their feet. There is still no petrol in the United in the southeast of the UK. We have empty shelves here. Everybody is saying that they're blaming Brexit and the way that the government is behaving this way. And yet, it is impossible for them to be touched. And Boris Johnson, I think a friend of mine said, you just watch, he's going to be in power for another, you know, until 2030. Not because he's particularly good or, you know, he could well be end up being a fabulous prime minister, but, you know, they all have other faults, right? The fact is that there is no one to take him on and there is no one to take the Tories on at the moment. And as a result, they can get a little bit complacent if they so wish. Was that the sense that you got?
I think the Tories are extremely complacent and I think that makes them vulnerable. I do agree with your friend. I think Johnson has a Trumpian ability to dodge the sort of scandals or mistakes or errors that would normally claim other ministers' or leaders' scalps. But a couple of things. I was very, very intrigued by this embrace that he urged voters to have of the petrol shortages, of the food shortages, the labour shortages, saying that this was all part of the Brexit dividend, that eventually they were going to shift the economy to one that was not reliant on cheap migrant labour, one that was going to be reliant on British labour and therefore higher wages. That's a very risky gamble, I think, but I can explain that because other conversations I had, the government is well aware that this sort of talk is actually really popular in the north. It's not so popular in the south, and voters aren't yet blaming the government for any of the woes that they might see on the supermarket shelves or at the petrol bowser.
So what are they blaming it
yet
on?
Right. But they are very terrified about what's coming down the line. And I think this is where the government's very vulnerable. And if they continue with the same complacent attitude, mind you, they've never had a good opposition here. They've never really been tested by a sensible opposition. That looks like it could change. I do think there are some vulnerabilities, but I do overall agree that I think Boris Johnson would lead the Tories to the next election and win.
Lasika Burke, stay with us. We'll have more from you a little later on. We'll be joined in the studio by Gillian de Bias, who'll be talking to us about her experiences in Paris in the last couple of weeks. And we'll bring in the issue that you mentioned at the top of the programme, that maybe the French want to make a bit of a land grab for European language. But let's head over to Italy now, to Turin, where Monocle's own culture editor Chiara Rimella is joining us. Buongiorno, Chiara.
Buongiorno to you, Emma.
How are you getting on in Turin? How is Turin this morning?
Well, actually, you find me in Piedmont, but not in Turin. I'm in Alba because I've swiftly had to move on from me being in Turin for a very interesting urbanism conference where we spoke and we attended, and it was very interesting. But I'm in Alba now because today is the opening of the International Truffle Fair, which I think will probably tickle your interest.
Totally.
I'm here for a story for Confect, so hopefully readers will find that on the pages soon enough.
I can't tell you what's just happened to Latika Book when you said truffle fair. There was movement. Tell us about the truffle. Right, we'll do the urbanism contest in a moment. That's interesting, but let's get the important stuff talked about. Tell us about the truffle fair.
Well, the truffle fair is actually a very international occurrence. I mean, Alba is a tiny town in Piedmont, but it's very famous internationally for its white truffle. And so people come here from all over the world for the prize, kind of white truffle of Alba. And it's a, you know, again, it's another one of those occasions where after COVID, you know, there is a sense that this is a huge kind of great opportunity for bringing people together here. And, you know, the hotels are booked up. And I think also restaurant bookings around will be quite tough to find.
Have you had a taste of an Alba white truffle yet? Or is this just something that you have to sort of save yourself up for in so many different, you build up to the big moment?
I haven't yet, because it is, after all, 10 a.m. I'll give it until lunchtime.
Frankly, Kara, I'm disappointed in you.
I know, I'm so sorry. I didn't go for the breakfast croissant with truffle. I'm so sorry. I go for a normal croissant water. I'm so sorry.
I mean, are the truffles in abundance here? Or is this one of those things that suddenly everything becomes with truffle? Or is that something that we mere mortals in the United Kingdom could only dream of?
Well, I think that the truffle that kind of travels internationally is not the prized kind of white truffle of Alba, which is very specific to this area. It's very, very expensive. And it's the kind of the top range, you would say, of the truffle. You know, so the truffle oil that you get in the pizzeria in London is kind of miles and miles and miles away from this kind of stuff, which is, you know, hundreds of years. And it's quite interesting. There will be quite a spectacle today at the fair, because you can get a kind of olfactory tasting, so they put a truffle into a wine glass and then you smell it, and the whole experience is very kind of sensorial. And then there's auctions traditionally of the truffle, so these massive kind of, I guess, mushroom-like, you know, produce is auctioned like it was a jewel. You know, it's very interesting the attitude that people have towards this very prized delicacy, which is not just a food stuff, but it really is kind of this cultural and prized entity.
Oh, I have plenty of reverence for a truffle, believe me, and so does Latifa. Okay, let's drag ourselves away from the truffle buffet and head back to Turin. Tell us a little bit about the urbanism conference that you've been to.
Well, it was really interesting. This is Torino Stratosferica, who are an organization that is, I guess, proposing new solutions for the city. They're really taking matters in their own hands and coming up with some very practical, some more kind of utopian solutions for the city. They put on a festival that's called Utopian Hours. You can guess from the title that it is very much about big ideas. And they bring in speakers from really around the world. So you've got people from, you know, it was a video conference from New York, from the founder of the High Line, but also people from Canada speaking, people from Cyprus, from really from Lagos, Nigeria, bringing their experiencing of city building, wherever they are, all the way to Turin. And it's interesting, I think, because it goes to prove that despite not being perhaps the most famous city in Italy, Turin is a place that is willing to have these conversations and these kind of experimental ideas being thrown around. And this organization, other than putting on the festival, has also actually realized the project. They've made a linear park in a formerly, I guess, disused tram line. And so they're kind of moving from idea also to reality. It's very interesting to see this happen in Turin right now, where the audience was quite, you know, they came out and sold out a lot of the events. So there's also interest on the ground to listen to these stories and to make things happen for the city.
Indeed, I mean, this lovely transformation of the old tram track. It's on the it's a new imaging project, Torino Stratosferica, which opened there. The fact that Torino may not, you know, jump up there right to the top of the urbanist favourite cities on earth, how much freedom do you think that gives a city to think, okay, I don't have any pressure, let's see what we can do?
Well, I think that, you know, when you have to consider the fact that bureaucratic structures in Italy are perhaps more cumbersome than many other countries. So experimentation always has to go through all the loops and all the different steps that come with kind of public governance, which here is very much involved. But I think that there are labs that are trying to shake things up, because, you know, ultimately, urbanistically speaking and architecturally speaking, a lot of Italian cities are very traditional because we have this amazing heritage. But looking after the heritage sometimes comes at a bit of a cost, because there is less willingness to try and do new things, because there is much more of an emphasis on preservation than there is on kind of innovation. And I think, without obviously being disrespectful of the tradition, there is space at this point in time to try and think about something new. And that's what Torino Stratosferica are doing.
It's an excellent thing. I mean, I think it was, I was just reading somewhere that in the late 17th century, Turin was going to be wiped off the European map. But the Savoy family sort of depicted an image of the city that it basically Turin is perhaps a brilliant example of massive ambition when it comes to urbanism, that you can invent a city, obviously, from nowhere at a point of deep danger. Is there still that sense, you know, despite all the bureaucracy, that Turin is somewhere that we should all be looking for good ideas?
Well, I think that Turin has had a bad rap for a very long time as a kind of the industrial city of the north of Italy. Obviously, the T in Fiat stands for Turin, so Fabbrica Italiana Automobili Torino, right? So this was the city in the north that people would immigrate to go work at the factory. It had this kind of sense of greyness about it. And then I think from the 90s onwards, it helped very much from the cultural sphere, particularly the music scene really exploded in the city, and it was very experimental. There is a great tradition of, I guess, like electronic music, for example, in Turin, which is why the Club to Club festival, which started out again as a smaller festival, now is a very internationally renowned music of an electronic, kind of experimental electronic music festival. So it's not just about clubbing, but it's also about people who are pushing the boundaries there. So I think it started out with music, as it often does. It starts out with these kind of artistic expressions. And then now it's a place that I think has become, yes, freer perhaps, because less explored than the equivalent of Milan, to actually be on the cusp of something new and something different. We hosted the Winter Olympics, obviously, and that was a great time for the city to completely reinvent itself and really present itself to the world as a place that had meaning and had kind of international relevance. And I think now we may be onto something again from the point of view of being on the world stage with Eurovision next year, because that's the big news of the weekend, right?
Well, this is what I could sense you were leading us to all that with experimental music. Not much experimental music in the more traditional sense, but certainly a reinvention of Turin, a brilliant coup for Turin to get Eurovision next year. I mean, that's huge.
Yeah, it is huge, actually, because there was a bit of rumour leading up to this decision, but there were other 16 cities in the running and much bigger cities as well that would have had the infrastructure to host this. I think it's interesting that Turin was chosen for a number of reasons. Obviously, we've talked about the kind of the cultural relevance of the city. It's also interesting that we do have the infrastructure ready. We hosted the Winter Olympics in 2006, and the Palazzo Ballo Olimpico, where actually the Eurovision is going to be hosted, is the legacy of that. Of that building, you know, it's known by Turinese as Palais Zuzzacchi, so it was a big new commission done by Zuzzacchi the architect that's been used and left in the city, that it has been used for music events, and it's great to see the Olympic legacy kind of lived on and lived in as well. I think it's interesting because Eurovision has already been hosted in Italy two times before, once in Naples and then in Rome. It's interesting they're going for a smaller, lesser-known city, because I think in the last few years we've seen repeatedly Eurovision take on cities that perhaps aren't quite as big as the major capitals. Obviously, if a country wins a Eurovision for the first time, then obviously it's going to bring it to the capital because it makes sense to kind of celebrate the whole country. But if the country has already hosted Eurovision in the past, it makes sense for Eurovision to come to the city and really become a festival of the city as well. You know, when Eurovision does happen next May in Turin, nobody's going to be able to ignore it, you know? It's really going to be a very perceptible thing on the street, because it's not a tiny town, but it's small enough, especially in central, that if you see kind of international, you know, plane loads of revelers coming in for the festival, you will notice a sensible difference on the streets. And I think that's also what the organization wants. It wants to be not just a side event in a large city, but it wants to be a celebration of everything together. And in this respect, I think Turin will play an excellent kind of host city, because it will embrace it completely, definitely.
Finally, you're a very good gauge of things. Does Turin know how to have a party that's enough for Eurovision, that could handle Eurovision?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, actually, despite it, again, like its grey kind of rap that it's had for a very long time, this is the centre of nightlife for Italy for the last few decades, in the Murazzi area, and perhaps new proposals for new kind of nightclub districts will make this a place where you will have a sufficiently very satisfactory night out, I would say.
I can't wait. Book me a place and bring me back a truffle if you can. Difficult, I understand.
We'll keep it on the side, yes.
So keep it on the side. Keep it in a little jar. Karimela in Turin, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be hearing more from Latika Burke, and our Gillian De Bias has joined me in this studio. But I'm Emma Nelson, and you're listening to Monocle on Sunday. We'll be right back after this.
The Monocle Media Summit is back. Join our editors for a look at the brands, correspondents and titles that are shaping the media landscape and steering its future. This year, the event will also mark Monocle 24's 10th birthday, so we're putting a special focus on broadcast media. A packed afternoon of panels will once again be hosted by Monocle's founder Tyler Brulé and editor-in-chief Andrew Tuck, along with colleagues from print and radio. The session will feature insights from a stellar lineup of industry leaders, like CNN Chief International Correspondent Clarissa Ward, Bild-Zeitung's Deputy Editor and Chief International Reporter Paul Ronsheimer, Zeit Magazin's Christoph Ament, author and researcher Jess Henderson, Finnish TV anchor Matti Ronka, and his BBC TV and radio counterpart Michel Hussein. Plus, there's a chance to watch a special live broadcast of the Monocle Daily on location. And after that, you can meet and talk shop with the speakers and the Monocle crew over drinks. The Monocle Media Summit is taking place on Thursday, the 14th of October, at the Hyatt Regency London, the Churchill Hotel, W1. As a Monocle listener, you can get 10% off your ticket. Head to monocle.com now and enter the promo code M24BIRTHDAY. We look forward to seeing you there.
Welcome back to Monocle on Sunday with me, Emma Nelson. Well, as we have probably guessed from the last half hour of today's programme, Monocle's team has been busy in the last couple of weeks, out and about reporting and travelling once again. The absolute joy of just getting some shoe leather worn down is amazing. Well, one person who's been on the road is our very own Gillian De Bias. Good morning, Gillian.
Good morning, Emma.
Fresh from Paris.
Yes, and as you say, it is a joy, you know, just getting on that Eurostar and getting off at Gare du Nord and the sounds and the smells. And having not been to a city that one has such a relationship with, it's really such a fascinating journey to almost have a conversation with it again over 2 weeks, you know, exploring it, walking it, and delving into new and familiar parts.
Okay, what set your world alight on your wonderful reverie if you know Gillian, she's a big fan. You're a big fan of Paris, aren't you? And in the same way that Latika's face changed when we heard truffle. When you say Paris to Gillian, you get the same face, basically. These are like easy trigger points.
Well, I suppose, first of all, work-wise, you know, it was Paris Fashion Week. And, there was an incredible energy there. And what I loved about it this year, it was really the first season that it was the return to physical shows. But similarly to how the city is going to cope with the Olympics, this year, some of the biggest houses decided to use the city itself as a backdrop, which in the month of October is a bit of a brave thing to do because of the weather. But take YSL's first return to the catwalk. They were on the Trocadero, and their show had the backdrop of the lit up Eiffel Tower. Chloe used the banks of the River Seine. Never before, really, for Fashion Week has the city exterior be used in this way. And it really was a very exciting prelude to the Olympics, where they're going to, you know, put sports throughout all the most famous landmarks.
I think you've hit on a very good point here, is that Paris is well, it knows what to do with itself because it knows it's very beautiful. And so it can create a scene out of practically any street corner. There's always that glorious thing that whenever you emerge from a tube station, the metro, you come up and there's always something exciting to see. So it is its own backdrop. But if we have this sort of Paris Fashion Show, which was just full of joy and fun, and for the first time, I mean, listening to Dana Thomas a little bit earlier on this week on Monocle 24, she and I were talking about the fact that people were laughing, which is that does not happen.
Well, on and off the catwalk, because, you know, catwalks are notoriously serious affairs where these poor models in their high-heeled shoes just have these glum faces, which is de rigueur for fashion shows. And you're watching these and they're smiling, which I think is a reflection of an industry back on its feet, you know, whether it's luxury fashion, whether it's people expressing themselves and people getting together. And so it was an emotional and very joyous Fashion Week, which was also matched by very buoyant sales.
What was your highlight?
I mean, I think one of the things which I loved is because I've been a huge fan of Albert Elbaz, who sadly passed away earlier this year. And there's the end to Fashion Week this season was a tribute from his company, AZ Factory, which actually brought together 47 of the top designers around the world to design one outfit that quintessentially encapsulated this incredible designer who had a passion for fashion. The inspiration was the Théâtre du Monde, which was the 1945 sort of soft power exercise from the French fashion world to kind of promote their creativity after the war, where little tiny mannequins were presented with the fashion models. And Albert Elbaz always wanted to do the same. So for a notoriously competitive industry, it was extremely moving to see them all come together and create one outfit to tribute this designer who was so passionate about fashion.
One thing that was a beautiful thing to see from afar was Christo's love affair with Paris, the artist. Now, I always firmly believe that Christo did outside art like nobody else, taking a space with him and his wife and creating glorious fun, but at the same time making very serious and beautiful big statements. His final statement to the world was wrapping the Arc de Triomphe. Did you see it?
It's a magnet for anyone who is in Paris, exactly. Local from abroad. You just cannot. It was I think it was up for 2 weeks. But, you know, it talks again about Paris and its icons and how they can become cliches. But you take the Arc de Triomphe, everyone knows the Arc de Triomphe. It's heady with history, of course, a tribute to the Napoleonic Wars and glory for battle. And yet it has become so important to the Parisians, to the French. You know, it's where the Tomb to the Unknown Warrior is, the scene of protest. And Paris was his city of escape. Paris was where Christo fled to from Bulgaria. And he loves the city so much, and he takes this iconic Arc de Triomphe and he wraps it. It's like a shroud. And it is incredibly moving, because I think everyone can look at this very, very familiar, iconic monument, which they've taken to granted because we all see it. And suddenly you think about it in a different way, because it's sort of fairly ghost-like and it's washed with the light of Paris from all times of day. It looks different. And it makes you look at your city in a different way and monuments in a different way. And I was actually very tempted to, as I passed one of the tourist shops, buy myself a little toy Eiffel Tower and a handkerchief and play around so I could have my own wrapped Arc de Triomphe when I return home to London.
How glorious. Well, I'm sure we can oblige. We can come around to your house and build it. Unfortunately, we can't have anything more from Christo. It was a real loss to the world when he died. Wonderful. Wonderful, wonderful. The return of the Samaritaine as well. This glorious, but it's not a department store, it's a way of life, that sits on the banks of the Seine and for years and years and years has been just left and was, you know, it's just rather depressing sight on the side. I mean, I used to love going on the top of the roof of the Samaritaine. And then little did we know that inside, huge amounts of magical transformations are taking place. And now it is something else.
Well, it was always a worry because, anyone who's been into the Samaritaine department store before it closed down and saw its stunning Art Deco and Art Nouveau architecture, the extraordinary atrium with the Eiffel-like structure of stairwells that are almost Easter-esque. And it closed down, and the worry was always that it would be knocked down, that it would be just turned into office blocks. So there was always a bit of a tragic feeling when you walked across the Pont Neuf and saw it there. Are very sad and vacant. But LVMH bought it, and it's had a 15-year incredible restoration, calling on all the craftsmen around France, a bit like Notre Dame across the road, gilders and painters and sculptors. And it finally has reopened in this extraordinary I wouldn't call it department store. It's really an ode to luxury. But it has, it's a chance for people to visit this beautiful, beautiful architectural piece of Parisian heritage.
That's gorgeous. Thank you so much, Gillian Devine. Stay with us, Gillian, because let's go through the papers again. And Letica, welcome back.
Oh, I could listen to her talk about Paris all morning. I just went to Paris a couple of weeks ago, and it was exactly as you say, like reopening a conversation.
Oh, forget Emily in Paris. We got Gillian in Paris. Yeah.
Let's all go to Paris.
Fall over.
What are you doing after this show? Should we just hop on the Eurostar?
I think I'll just have to swoon. Okay. One of the most beautiful things about Paris, arguably, is the language. French is a glorious, if rather complicated and subtle and difficult to pronounce language. You're talking to someone who learned it at school. It wants to be the language of the European Union. This is a great story, Latika.
I absolutely adore this story. It's reported in the Daily Telegraph today. Now, it's this movement by what looks to be a ragtag band of about 40 French MPs who have hatched up a little plot. Now that Britain has sauntered on out of the European Union, it thinks that, hey, hang on, why is English still the working language of the EU? Let's make it French again. And so these MPs have put forward a resolution to effectively reinstate French as the official working language of Europe. Now, facts. There are three working languages of the EU, Emma. They're English, French and German. And English and French have always, of course, tended to be preferred, with English in the last few decades becoming the dominant language. Now, Julien Aubert, who is on the fringes of the centre-right Republicans, tabled this resolution. And it displays a lot of wonderful self-awareness, which, might we say, can sometimes be lacking with the French, because even this resolution admits that there are more German native speakers in the EU as a result of Britain leaving the European Union than there might be French. So naturally, of course, if you're going to go on pure dominant terms, it would be German that should be the working language. But Mr. Aubert, or Monsieur Aubert, says French has a greater international profile than German.
Probably does, and he's probably right. And it's also, it is, you know, in historically the language of diplomacy, and it is an incredibly subtle language.
And it's beautiful and pretty.
It's really hard to read. The whole idea, though, is the subtlety of French language. I think someone noticed a few weeks ago, you know, when when Canberra decided that it was going to walk away from the French submarine builder naval group. And just before Jean-Yves Le Drian went bananas and started saying stabbing, treason, and sort of like pulled out the guns.
To the barricades.
The French Foreign Affairs and Defence Ministers released a very, very short statement to note the unfortunate decision. And the weight carried with those short, tiny words was enormous, in a way that, I mean, German would require, let us say, a few more words and a sort of few more composite clauses as well.
Yes, they do the disappointment, not anger, so well, the French, don't they? they do convey all the emotion they need. But it doesn't look, Emma, like this motion would really go anywhere, because it would need Macron to take it on and force it through. But I do enjoy this little factoid too. With Britain gone out of the EU, the only English-speaking countries left are
Ireland
and,
oh God,
Malta.
Sorry, yes, my heartfelt sincere apologies to Malta. I'm so sorry.
I thought that was very interesting.
I knew there was another one, and it wasn't Gibraltar, because obviously that's British. That is actually part of the United Kingdom. But it was Malta. Well, sorry, Malta. Gillian, how do you feel about teaching every single policy maker and bureaucrat inside Brussels a little bit of French? I mean, they speak French there anyway. So.
Well, you know, you can't help but wonder my response that, yes, of course, it would be wonderful to have the beautiful language of French as the language of the EU. But what was frustrating with me is I was surprised that, you know, I was trying to practice my best French, and I was amazed at how people in France were enjoying speaking English. It was like, no!
This is a change. You're
it
quite right. This is a change.
Because I remember, never the case.
Never the case. Years and years and years ago, you went to France, and if you didn't speak French, yeah, tough luck.
And even if you just spoke French, okay, they still were not very happy with
it. No, absolutely not. And then when you spoke French, they told you that you spoke French badly, yes, and then that was the end. This has all changed, hasn't it? I mean, I'm hearing lots of reports that this is a lovely, you know, wild and open city now that will even embrace English. Emmanuel Macron and that, and our French politician must be going bananas.
I have to say, I have never encountered this snobby French attitude that's so revered, you know, so famed. Every time,
you might not be British. I think
think and I was, you have led me exactly to the point, Emma. Every time I go to France, and I did learn it for a bit at school, so I try. Mm. And then, of course, when I say I can't speak it very well, do you speak English? They ask where you're from. As soon as I say Australia, I do see a different little gleam in the eye.
Now, how do you think that might have changed in the last month?
Well, I haven't been back since. I don't know if I should grace Gare du Nord very soon. I may have to practice my British accent then.
I mean, being
Canadian.
Well, have you done anything too dreadful in the last few months? You've been okay. You're right. I mean, you haven't closed any you haven't sort of like dropped any major nuclear submarine deals or left the European Union. I think they might still like you a little bit. Whereas Latika and I think our hopes are lost.
Yes.
It is that thing though, that actually from an entirely practical point of view, English is an incredibly easy language to learn. You can communicate really, really beautifully, because this is so boring. The verb doesn't change. I go, you go, he goes, she goes, we go, right? Really, really easy. When it comes to French, I mean, they have national competitions to actually be able to spell the language as it is written. And it is a huge thing in France. French children have dictée each week to teach them to actually write down French words, because the subtleties and the infinite variations in the spelling of a word would make any diplomat's head spin.
You know, there's this great time when I was covering NATO a couple of years ago, and I don't know if you remember, there was this footage the night before the summit where Macron and a couple of other leaders, I think it was Trudeau and maybe Boris, were all together, and they were caught laughing on camera at Donald Trump at his expense. And Trump was very, very upset by this, of course, being Trump. Now, the next day, Macron was asked about this, and I was sitting in his press conference listening to the translation, and he used this word in French, which was translated in English to mean cheated. And he was trying to say that this video was recorded and it was cheated, like a stolen kiss. So you shouldn't have had access to this conversation. But it was such an interesting translation, because all the English language journalists tweeted this out immediately, and it sounded very, very odd to hear Macron saying that we'd stolen or cheated by obtaining this footage, when of course it was right there. But I later ran into one of the French officials, and she said, oh, no, that word means something very, very different in French. It's much more subtle than that. And she was very intrigued to learn how it had been translated into English for us.
Fewer words, a lot more to say. It's 9:46 here in London. You're listening to Monocle on Sunday with me, Emma Nelson. We'll be going to Zurich in just a moment. Now, the 17th edition of the Zurich Film Festival drew to a close last week. The competition for the top prizes were fierce, and the city was buzzing with excitement as it played host to an array of international guests. Let's cross over now to our Zurich headquarters to Dufourstrasse 90 and hear from the film producer Solène Léger. Good morning, Solène. How is Dufourstrasse 90 this morning?
Good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
A little cloudy this morning, but we are expecting some sun a little later this afternoon.
Now, everything's calmed down just a little bit after last week's big parties at the Zurich Film Festival. I mean, it was an astonishing sight last Saturday evening when the space in front of the opera was basically turned into the most glorious red carpet.
Absolutely amazing. Yeah, you know, that was such an amazing festival this year. And let's start by telling you that it attracted more than 100,000 people. It's 50% increase from last year. Of course, last year the attendance was, of course, limited by COVID-19 restriction. But this year, again, big stars traveled to Zurich to be celebrated. I don't know if you know who was there, but Sharon Stone was there to receive the Golden Icon, So she was celebrating. You also had the director, Italian director Paolo Sorrentino, and I was very happy about this one. The French legend Jacques Audiard, the director, was also at the festival to present his last film, The Olympiad.
Tell us about what the highlights of. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, the big names arriving in Zurich, but what were the big films that perhaps Zurich shed light upon that perhaps we might not have known about?
Yeah, no, you're totally right. No, the Zurich Film Festival has become a major platform for Swiss film. Most of Switzerland's biggest box office hits have a premiere at the festival. And actually, the one who won the GoldenEye in the Focus competition went to the Swiss film La Mif by Fred Baillif for his social drama set in a home for girls. And the amazing story behind that film is that the director is a former social worker himself, and he worked hand in hand for over 2 years with his protagonist, a cast composed of natural actors. The girls were actually living at a Geneva care home. And the director also let the teenage girls participate in the script, which added, to the remarkable performances. You have to see the film. It's absolutely amazing. And they obviously won.
Tell us a little bit more about what else your highlights were, because it is a sort of a spotlight on Swiss film, and perhaps I'm being not particularly fair on Swiss film, but it doesn't necessarily occupy a very prominent role in the world of cinema.
Totally, no, you're totally right. But the Zurich Film Festival is really impulsing something new. So a lot of films that premiere at the Zurich Film Festival traveled after to the Venice Film Festival, to Cannes. So everything starts in Zurich for a lot of Swiss films. So, the founder himself of, the new CEO of the Zurich Film Festival said that he has a mission for Swiss film, because, two-thirds of the Swiss film industry is located in Zurich. So it became a very, very important place for Swiss film. And everything starts with that amazing festival.
It involved the city astonishingly. I mean, you couldn't go anywhere without seeing a Zurich Film Festival logo coming out of every single shop window. It's crazy.
And even everywhere.
I was in a hotel, and the whole of the top floor of the hotel that I was in had been taken over by Netflix, who are doing all their press junkets for a new miniseries. And it's astonishing how Zurich, it's a big enough city, but it seemed as if, the Zurich Film Festival was everywhere.
Not totally. No, you're totally right. It's like for the whole festival, Zurich is only bidding for cinema. So it's absolutely joyful to see it. And what I love, especially this year, one of the biggest news is an important upgrade. I think it's the new impressive venue, the 1,600 seat main hall of the renovated Zurich Convention Center, where the festival projected the James Bond film. It was the biggest movie the Zurich Film Festival had since its establishment in 2005. So very joyful to be back in theaters and in such a big capacity for such a joyful film. I was absolutely amazed.
Thank you so much for joining us on the line from Dufourstrasse 90. Solène Léger, the film producer. You're listening to Monocle on Sunday. Finally, what's a lazy Sunday morning without a weekend crossword? All this week, we're playing clips from the Monocle 24 archives to celebrate our 10th birthday. Let's hear from an American crossword champion called Daniel Feyer. He talked about his achievements in competitions to Pauline Eiferman.
I use the first puzzle to calm my nerves a little bit. When you finish the puzzle, you'll check the clock first thing. The scoring is done by minute, so if you finish the puzzle and you've got 40 seconds left in the minute, you'll use that 40 seconds to check your grid, make sure there's no empty squares. That was a mistake I made one year. I feel like I have to just keep it up and not make a mistake. I don't want to try too hard. I don't want to race too fast. We're all nerding out about crosswords, and these crosswords in particular, which are usually the best ones, some of the best ones that we see all year.
On your mark, get set, go.
I always did puzzles when I was a kid, but I wasn't call myself a puzzle person. I started doing the Sunday New York Times crossword in college when I got my hands on the Times magazine. I would help my aunt solve the Sunday puzzle because she liked to do that. I didn't really get into puzzles seriously until I saw the movie Wordplay.
A dramatic come from behind last second victory. Ellen is the winner. Hollywood couldn't have scripted a better finish.
I found out that the crossword tournament was going to be in Brooklyn that year for the first time. And since I lived in New York and I had that weekend free, I thought, oh, I like to do crosswords. Maybe I will check it out.
And in the few months leading up to that first tournament, I got hooked. I started downloading all of the crosswords online that I could. I bought a whole bunch of puzzle books. I bought a book of past tournament puzzles and started solving those. And I did pretty well the first time. And by that point, I was totally addicted. I started doing probably 20 to 25 puzzles per day on average, and I was getting faster very quickly. Over the next couple of years, I worked my way up to the top of the top of the standings.
So you actually got interested in crossword puzzles seriously because of the tournament. Can you describe what the atmosphere is like during a competition like that?
There's 600 people in a room sitting at long tables, all solving the same puzzle. So it's very quiet. And slowly people finish and start walking out of the room and going out into the hallway and talking about how fast we all did that puzzle and whether we all made a mistake. Checking if there are any questionable crossings, we will compare notes and see if we all got it correct. The people that come to a crossword tournament are all very interested in words, so they're interesting people from all walks of life. It's a surprisingly friendly group. Especially among the top competitors, we're all friends, we're not really rivals, and we support each other. We're happy whoever comes away with the title, I think.
You mentioned that you do 20 to 25 puzzles a day. What else do you get when you compete? Why compete?
Well, at this point, I'm showing up because I have a chance at winning a cash prize. The reason a lot of people show up is not because they're trying to win a prize, but because it's the main meeting place. It's the main convention for crossword fans around the country and around North America.
So you flew in from San Francisco this morning to compete. Is there any way you're preparing for this weekend?
I've been doing more puzzles in the last couple of weeks than I usually do. I've printed out a bunch of extra puzzles from the archives of the New York Times. I've gotten a couple of books to work through, and all of the daily puzzles that I would usually do on my computer, I'm printing out and doing on paper because that's how the tournament is run. It's all pencil and paper.
What is the difference?
I'm faster solving on the computer than on paper, and I don't have to print it out, waste paper and ink, and I can do it faster when I'm typing than writing. So for most of the year, I'll do the Times and all the other puzzles on my computer on a program called Across Light. But for the last month or two before the tournament, increasingly I will print them out and do them on paper so that I can practice having my eye go to the right place. The hardest part about solving on paper is looking in the right place. I'm looking at 24 across, my eye has to go to the clue for 24 across and find it immediately in the list and then go back. So it's jumping back and forth between writing in the grid and finding the right clues. And I've usually got more than one clue in my head at the same time. I'm trying to write constantly and look here, there, up and down at the right clue. So getting into that groove is the most important thing I can do before the tournament so that I don't waste precious seconds trying to find a clue.
And would you consider competing internationally?
No. If people call me the world champion at crosswords, I have to correct them because I can't beat Englishmen at a British-style crossword, which are a different style. Those are what we call cryptic crosswords in America. And I'm decent at those, but I can't do the crosswords in The Guardian, for instance, which, you know, a Brit can knock off in 15 minutes if they're good. And I don't speak any other languages, so I can't do French crosswords or Italian crosswords or Japanese crosswords. Almost every language has a style of crosswords. It's popular all around the world, but I can't do any of them except for American crosswords.
Nine-letter word for cocktail with a cherry. 15-letter word for resistant to moisture, say.
A man who really knows what he likes there, the American crossword champion, Daniel Feyer. Well, one of Monocle 24's top 100 moments there. We will be continuing our countdown to our anniversary throughout the week, but why not join us and our panellists on Thursday, the 14th of October, for the Monocle Media Summit right here in London. We'll be discussing the future of the industry, reflecting on the last 12 months, and even bringing you one of our shows live in front of a studio audience. Oh, and there's drinks too. It wouldn't be a celebration without raising a glass or two, would it? We would love to see you there. And and as a thank you for your loyalty over the years. If you enter the code M24BIRTHDAY at our website, you'll get a 10% discount exclusive to our listeners. All details can be found at monocle.com. But for now, it's all the time we've had for today's edition of Monocle on Sunday. Thanks to our guests, Atika Burke, Chiara Rimella, Gillinda Bison, Solin Leger, and Tyler Brulé. And our producers, Carlotta Rebello. Our studio manager in Zurich was Desiree Bandley, and Nora Hull was looking after the sound here in London. I'm Emma Nelson. Monocle on Sunday returns next week, but enjoy the rest of your weekend. Goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.